KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, UC Berkeley Professor Emeritus Frederick Cruz draws on extensive research in his new critique of the father of psychoanalysis, his book, Freud, The Making of an Illusion. Cruz joins us in studio to talk about how Freud lied about case histories to advance his career, mishandled patients, and promoted cocaine as a miracle cure for many illnesses. And decades ago, Cruz skewered the field of literary criticism with The Pooh Perplex and Postmodern Pooh. We'll talk about Freud, psychoanalysis, and literary criticism. It's all coming up next, right after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In his new book, Freud, The Making of an Illusion, UC Berkeley Professor Emeritus Frederick Cruz argues that Sigmund Freud's ambitious nature came to overshadow the work he championed, and he says that Freud covered up errors and manipulated findings to protect his reputation and position in the burgeoning field of psychotherapy. And he says much more than that as well, and we're going to find out all of what he says, or as much of it as we can cover in this hour. Frederick Cruz, welcome back to Forum.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Good to have you here. 18 years ago, you were here with your first book that really was, well, very critical of Freud, almost dismantling Freud, or as some see it, demonizing Freud. Are you demonizing Freud?
Well, I don't think so, particularly in this book. This is not an attack on Freud. This is a biographical study that tries to show how his early career developed, how he moved away from his own scientific and medical training towards something very different.
Toward being, I think we could almost characterize as a con man, a guy of low character. I mean, that's really the portrait that you give us, and someone who, it's interesting the parallels as I was reading through your book that I came to things that have been said about our president, you know, a liar, a double crosser, a betrayer, etc.
Many people have said that to me, but the interesting thing is that Freud didn't start out that way at all. He started out wanting to succeed on a level playing field, and for one reason or another, he found that very difficult. But success was his uppermost aim, and he was just determined to be rich and famous.
Wasn't it more wanting to be a hero? I mean, he wanted fame, but he kept thinking, I remember dreaming about being Hannibal and all of those kinds of things. You know?
Hannibal was his childhood hero, but it was also his hero in his early adulthood. And there's a lot to be said about the private meaning of the general Hannibal for Freud. But basically, he wanted to conquer. He wanted to be the leader. And this was not necessarily the best motivation for a scientist. He didn't seem to have the kind of elementary curiosity about natural things that a great scientist has. But he did have a wish to dominate.
And a wish to make a lot of money, and we also bring forth things about endorsing cocaine with Big Pharma, or what amounted to the Big Pharma in Vienna at that time, which, you know, makes him come across, as I said, as a man of extremely low and venal character, even child molestation.
Well, we could talk about cocaine because out of the 35 chapters in my book, six are devoted just to the first cocaine episode in Freud's life. He continued to use cocaine in the 1890s when he was founding psychoanalysis. But from 1884 to 1887, he was, in effect, he was Europe's foremost advocate of the medical uses of cocaine. And he was taking it himself, and he used it supposedly to wean a friend of his from his morphine addiction. The result was he addicted the man doubly to morphine and cocaine with horrifying results. And I have a couple of chapters about that. It's really rather hair-raising. But let me say on Freud's behalf that at that time, nobody knew the dangers of cocaine. It was a perfectly legal drug. It was known better in America than in Europe. And Freud got hold of some American papers on the subject and decided that's how he would become rich and famous, through advocating the medical uses of cocaine in Europe.
So he became a shill, in effect, as you write about it.
Well, he did. He descended rather low, doing essentially a product endorsement, and I do have a chapter about that.
Well, there are a lot of disturbing things about Freud that you bring about, but the trajectory, as you say, is from what someone who began as a dedicated scientist and then became corrupted perhaps by his dreams, his fantasies, but also created, I mean, this is also a very strong critique of psychoanalysis. He created what you call an illusion and created something that you feel has not been in the best interest of humanity or served humanity.
Well, I don't want to pass judgments about the present state of psychoanalysis. I would have to be a fly on the wall to tell you what that state is. I think every practitioner is different. I think my principal objection is that psychoanalysis claims to have gone so far from Freud now that the analysts really shouldn't be invoking Freud as their kind of logo the way they do.
Doesn't Freud, though, present us with someone who, whatever he may have cannibalized off others who preceded him, and that's a big part of your critique as well, who gave us the building blocks of psychology, and not only psychoanalysis, but what we consider to be modern psychology. I mean, he was the one who said, yeah, the poets invented the unconscious or presented the unconscious to us, but here's what the unconscious is, and there's a structure that I have, id, ego, superego, all these things that we take for granted now, they've become part of our essentially everyday lives.
They are part of our culture, and, you know, medical fads die hard. We talk about people being dyspeptic or bilious and so forth. This is the medicine of an earlier century. Freud is going to remain within our culture for a long time, but my book, being biographical, is really obliged to look into the question of whether or not he actually founded sympathetic psychotherapy, whether he actually healed anybody.
Say he didn't cure anybody. I mean, essentially, you take that point of view.
According to his own letters, he didn't cure anybody. And, you know, in 1930, he confessed rather casually in a paper. He said, quote, "I have never been a therapeutic enthusiast." But up until that point, that's exactly how he portrayed himself. And his advocacy for psychoanalysis often took the form of saying, this is the sovereign cure for human neurosis. He was just simply lying about it.
He also said that dreams are the royal road to the unconscious, and we've got a lot of data now that proves that they may not be the royal road to anything. They may just be a lot of flotsam and jetsam and all that sort of thing. I mean, he was wrong about a lot of stuff. He even had all those beliefs with Fleece that the nasal passages had to do with our minds. And a lot of people think the Oedipus complex and, you know, Freud really didn't get women with all that notion about penis envy and the rest. But he gave us ideas like ambivalence. He gave us ideas like repression. I mean, there's a lot to credit Freud for, isn't there?
The idea of repression was a commonplace of romantic medicine and philosophy the first half of the 19th century. The same is true of the idea of the unconscious. It was simply everywhere. Freud's medical professors were trying to develop scientific principles of analysis that did away with vague generalities like that. What Freud did essentially was to revert to romantic psychology, but he couched it in very deterministic terms, so it sounded extremely modern. It really wasn't.
He was really, in many ways, a Viennese 19th-century patriarch and had all the limitations and all the whatever else one wants to say about him, all that can be identified with that milieu and that world.
Well, I agree with you, Michael. You know, many people think of Freud as a great liberator in the realm of sexuality, but his attitudes were really rather backward compared to, let's say, Havelock Ellis or Albert Mohl or Richard von Krafft-Ebing. He was as obsessed with the evils of masturbation as any member of his generation was, and he remained that way.
But there's also the sense that he brought us into an awareness, especially early Freud, about eroticism and desire. I mean, may have been a lot of work that preceded his work, but he elevated it to a central role, and suddenly it was liberating for many people.
I think you're right in the sense that Freud became the person to whom everyone turned to symbolize, to represent the change in mores in the early 20th century, the decay of the old patriarchy, the idea of youthful rebellion, the idea of sexual freedom. People used Freud as the kind of icon of this whole movement. But when you study the facts of his life, this becomes rather ironical because he was one of the more prudish experts on sexuality of his generation.
You know, we've been talking about how Freud established his own, shall we say, footprint and made himself into this larger-than-life character. He was, in fact, he had descendants who were big in the PR business, and he was kind of a PR guy himself. But it also, I think, goes to people like Ernest Jones, and I mean, he had his daughter Anna Freud. They were all advanced people for him. They were doing a lot of the work that essentially constructed this image of Freud and this legendary quality that he had.
You couldn't be more right. You know, Freud died in 1939. Psychoanalysis, because of the Nazis, had to move very far west from Vienna and Budapest and Berlin to London and New York after the war. And Anna Freud was the leader of the movement, and she and some others, and chiefly Ernest Jones, but plenty of others, decided that they would canonize the legend of Freud to make him into almost a savior figure for modern humanity and someone who had discovered essential truths and who had a kind of kindly sympathy for suffering humankind. All of this is just completely false, and yet these ideas about Freud linger. And I'm quite aware that my book is going to offend a lot of people who still either believe in this whole legend or in lingering parts of it, because just one by one, well, not only do I try to explain why these views of Freud are not true, I also try to explain how his daughter and others actually constructed the legend.
We're talking about the life and legacy of Sigmund Freud with Frederick Cruz, who is the author of Freud, The Making of an Illusion. And some of you may indeed want to weigh in here and raise questions or comments. We invite you to be part of the program and to join the conversation. Let me give you our toll-free number. You can join us now at that number. It's 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join the program. It's live and interactive, and the number to call, 866-733-6786. Or join us with questions or comments by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any questions or comments you might have there at kqed.org/forum and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You're really dealing, I mean, in terms of the criticism of Freud with years between 1884 and 1900. That's a lot of the story that you feel, well, it's the crucial years, but the stories that haven't been told.
That's right. And let me say that in the book, I'm using a resource that has been almost completely neglected in Freud biography, and that is the engagement letters that Freud wrote, Freud and his fiancée, Martha Bernays, wrote to each other between 1882 and their marriage in 1886. That's 4.5 years of correspondence. They were apart almost the whole time. So there are 1,539 letters that are just amazingly rich for our sense of what Freud was really like. And yet only 100 or so of them had been published until quite recently. There's now a German edition coming out in 5 volumes, 3 of which have been published. But the Anna Freud was determined that these letters not be read in her lifetime, and they were embargoed within our own Library of Congress until the year 2000. They're still very hard to read because of Freud's handwriting, but I was able to read German typescripts of them, and a great deal of what goes on in the first half of my book comes out of these letters, so it's really quite new material.
He was a talented writer, though.
He was a terrific writer. The only problem was that he devoted that talent to self-promotion. If you look at, let's say, the English translation of Freud's writings, it's 23 volumes and an index. In those 23 volumes, there is not a single item of evidence presented for any of his views. Instead, what you get is the views themselves. You get promises that explanations will be forthcoming. You get assurances that all of this was explained before. And above all, what you get is self-dramatization. You get a picture of Freud as the master detective who is marvelously solved problems in the mode of Sherlock Holmes. And by the way, one of his favorite authors was Arthur Conan Doyle.
Well, you have a couple of epigraphs here. You may be the first writer in the history of Western civilization to pair Nietzsche with George Costanza. Talk about Nietzsche from the perspective of we all carry on our biographies, and what you realize, of course, in any assessment of Freud is that his own biography, his own life played a central role in so many of the postulates and hypotheses that he came to. But there's also that line of George Costanza's, is not a lie if you believe it, which also is a line in Sam Shepard's True West. So what you're suggesting is Freud had these illusions in many instances based on his own inner life and his own struggles with his own, shall we say, inner demons in many instances, and that's some form of prevarication. It's maybe, again, we think about Trump talking about all those people who were at his inauguration who weren't necessarily there, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a problem that can't be solved in any simple way. We have a man who tells certain lies that are just obviously false from any point of view about all the patients that he cured, for example. But on the other hand, he really seems to believe his own theory quite passionately and feels very defensive about any criticisms of it. And he's always going to fall back on some kind of reassertion of what he already believes. He doesn't really take the attitude of a scientist toward his own propositions. He takes the attitude of a self-promoter who's really facing too much criticism and is feeling quite defensive about it.
Well, he was, I think, described as a crypto-scientist by one of your colleagues from UC Berkeley. But also thinking about Bruno Bettelheim, who made quite a name for himself in psychoanalysis too, who also was in many ways a more terrible man, I think, than Freud personally. But he said, you know, that Freudian psychology was not necessarily meant to be all that scientific, that it was given all this scientific heft. But you think about the word psyche, you think about soul, and it has to do more with maybe being a soul doctor than being a scientist.
Yes. Bettelheim was criticizing James Strachey's translations into English of Freud's texts, and you're absolutely right. Freud's scientific language is full of elements of romantic vagueness and spirituality that are kind of smuggled in. And one of the reasons for Freud's success is that he really composed a completely ambiguous science, which was highly deterministic in its idiom and at the same time extremely diffuse in its actual propositions. You know, one reason why academic research has completely abandoned Freudian concepts is that they don't lend themselves to the kind of precise meaning that one could make predictions on.
But in our field, literature, there's an ongoing, in fact, I think it's mainly literature departments that continue to rely on psychoanalytic approaches, one could argue. But there's still a great deal of credence given to someone like Lacan, who was tremendously influenced by Freud, as so many were.
Well, what Lacan wanted to do was to radicalize Freud. He wanted to eliminate the bourgeois aspects of Freud, and he did so without any empirical reference whatsoever. I mean, Lacan, to my mind, was, you know, one of the biggest phonies of all time, and it's really kind of an indictment of certain parts of the humanities today that Lacan continues to have some currency, because really the man was making up a vocabulary of his own that simply didn't connect with the real world. He didn't even try to make it connect to the real world. He talked about a mirror stage of development, but he didn't study anybody to find out what that stage was.
Go to our callers. Before I do, though, let me ask you about Jung, because he had affairs with patients. He had a kind of weird notions about Nordic chauvinism and some loopy ideas that were real. I mean, you could take apart Jung in ways that are, frankly, just as substantive as you did with Freud, couldn't you?
I absolutely agree. I think, however, that Jung was an honest man. He was a bit of a mystic. He might have been a bit of a psychotic at times.
Well, he did have a mental breakdown.
Yeah. But he tried to tell the truth. So in some ways, I think he was a more attractive personality. But between the two of them, there is very little sense of testing one's propositions. And it's ironical because Jung started out being that way. He started out being very empirical, but partly under Freud's influence and partly under his own spiritual tendencies, he shifted around.
He broke away. Yeah, certainly broke away from Freud. Let me get Patricia on air as our first caller. Patricia, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment. I respect the research that goes into a book and the extensive thoughtfulness, and I haven't yet read the book. But and I don't mean to make any comments on Freud's personality. I do think many careers have been made discrediting Freud and demonizing him. But my real point is that as a dream studies researcher, anyone who's read what Freud has said about dreams, while he's also been discredited or argued against for many of his points, if you really are aware of the details of what he's tried to do, you have to appreciate his pursuit of what was really going on, how our dreams formed, and so on. And while we can disagree today, you know, this century later, I think it's really important not to over-demonize and, you know, appreciate what sorts of questions that he inspired at the very least.
Yeah, thank you for those comments. Yeah. Patricia, let me go to Fred Cruz on that. A lot of this has to do with the idea that Freud continues to influence so many things and is adapted to those things. I mean, dream studies, for example, would be a good illustration of that.
You know, my book is about how Freud lost his way as a scientist. If we look at his theory of dreams, let's talk about the options that Freud gives us for understanding a given image in a dream. He says, number one, the image can mean exactly what it seems to mean. Number two, it can mean exactly the opposite. Number three, it can mean something else. That's the so-called dream mechanism of displacement. So we have literal meaning, we have the denial of the meaning, we have the displacement of the meaning. That covers the entire universe of possibilities.
Yeah, but he also said that, you know, you can do psychotherapy by having a patient associate what the images may be with their own conscious mind, and that will bring out. And therapists to this day say this is a very useful concept when we're working with patients, not necessarily to find things like Dora or, you know, or all those little details that he went into with his patients in dreams. But yeah.
This is the problem with free association. Freud used free association not in order to find out what was deeply on his patients' minds, but to pounce on elements of their verbalization that would correspond to his
theory. That thought, Fred. We got a break. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the life and legacy of Sigmund Freud with Frederick Cruz, who compares Freud and his influence to Jesus and Shakespeare, but really goes quite at the Freudian legacy as well as the life of Freud. And we indeed welcome your responses. Before we went to the break, we were talking about dreams, though, and you wanted to follow through on that, Fred, and finish what you had in the way of thought.
Well, my point is that what Freud did with dreams was to assimilate them to his own theory. And he did that by positing dream mechanisms by which supposedly the dream thoughts were transmuted into dream images. But what those mechanisms actually were indulgences that Freud allowed himself in order to make sure that the dream would always mean what he wanted it to mean. So dreams reduce themselves to sexual and aggressive elements every time because the rules that Freud allowed himself to follow were conducive to that end.
But I had mentioned earlier that I know psychotherapists who say, you know, dreams can still be very useful in just getting associations from their patients. You had said something about free association not necessarily being all that important or overemphasized, whatever.
Well, free association is one of the very few elements of Freud's original psychology that one still finds in practice today. And I think it deserves a kind of hard look epistemologically, because if a therapist encourages a patient to just use language in a loose, unstructured way, and then lights upon certain elements of what the patient has said and asks them to associate further to those things, what's happening is that the associations themselves are being shaped in the direction of the therapist's ideas. So this is not a very good tool for getting at the truth. It may have a nice placebo effect, but it certainly doesn't have a very good reliability factor.
There is, essentially, in your judgments, clearly a lack of credence in most of what we could see today as modern psychoanalysis or modern psychotherapy, even though it's deviated so much from Freud. And I wonder, you know, notwithstanding all the levity that has been brought to the fore about Fred Cruz must have had a bad analyst and all those sorts of things, or maybe he didn't like his mother. I was just wondering, are you beating a dead horse here in some ways? I mean, Freud has been discredited and been demeaned. Most therapists say, well, we use a little of Freud, but not very much of that. I mean, in other words, he's certainly, as a figure, as a legendary figure, not given the credence or the idolatry by any stretch. He's not the icon he was, nor is psychoanalysis iconic.
That's true. However, it's generally believed that Freud was one of the most important, maybe even the most important, cultural figure of the 20th century. If that's so, we want to find out what his life was actually like, what his thought was actually like. As I've said before, we still are living within elements of the Freud legend that was constructed in the 1950s. What I'm trying to do here is not to refute Freud. I think that's been done over and over, and you know, I'm by far not the only person who's done so. What I'm trying to do now is to explain Freud, that is, to show how his thought process has changed, how he went from being a quite conventional scientist and physician to being essentially the founder of a cult around his own personality.
But you're also talking about his impact on humanity, and I think to some extent showing concern about that, aren't you?
Yes and no, really. In this book, I'm not concerned about his reputation. I know people feel that by concentrating only on mistakes that he made in his early life, I'm neglecting his influence in the 20th century. It's perfectly true that I'm neglecting it. It's just simply not part of my project.
Let's bring more callers in, and we go next to Kevin. Kevin, you're on.
Yes, you know, it would seem to me that the precise legacy of Freud is the psychopathology of his personal experience. In other words, he engaged in the observer problem and tried to make psychology into a science. And in failing to do so, he actually founds the idea of psychopathology as a subjective problem, and that in itself becomes the founding principle of what's left of psychology. You know, I remember reading Feynman's lectures on physics, and he said essentially that psychology was never going to be a science, that it was a form of witch doctoring. And I happen to agree with that, but not in a negative way. Comment.
Fred Cruz.
Well, first of all, I love Feynman. And what Feynman said was, if it doesn't correspond to experiment, it's wrong. I think that's an attitude that it would be very healthy for a lot of theorists in psychology to adopt. I don't think it's true that Freud introduced us to the idea of subjective psychopathology. If you read my book, you will find that long before Freud even coined the term psychoanalysis, there were a great many psychologists and philosophers in Europe who were mulling over the question of the unconscious, the question of hidden motivation. You know,
a Freudian slip not be called a Freudian slip?
Well,
that's right from the psychopathology of everyday life.
Yeah, the Freudian slip is certainly a concept of Freud's own, without doubt. If you read a book by a man named Sebastiano Timperano in published in 1974, called The Freudian Slip, you will see a linguist's critique of that idea. It's not that there's no such thing as a Freudian slip. Timpanaro agrees that there is such a thing. It's that Freud went way, way beyond reason in trying to assimilate all errors to his own style of error.
Speaking of assimilation, how much do we have to look at Sigmund Freud as a figure of... there are many, for example, who have posited that he identified with people who were traumatized and neurotic because he felt his identity as a Jew almost compelled that. Austria was not the greatest place for Jews then, and that turned out to be true as the years went by. And certainly he felt discrimination. It may have contributed to a lot of what you're talking about here.
Well, I think it did. This is a very, very tricky question. Freud never was tempted to deny his ethnic identity. At the same time, he was absolutely against Judaism as a religion. He also came from, you know, a lower class background that was subject to a particular kind of discrimination, even among Jews. And Freud himself showed a good deal of prejudice toward Polish Jews, toward Galician Jews, and I think in his career he was most anxious to move into a higher social order so that he would not be subjected to the kind of criticism that his parents were. So anti-Semitism is a complex question in Freud. You're certainly right to say that he felt oppressed by the horrible prejudice that was developing rapidly in the 1890s and really changed his perspective on how much of a career he would be able to have. But at the same time, at the end of his life, he writes Moses and Monotheism. You know, on the eve of the Holocaust, he writes a book that takes a quite negative view of the ancient Hebrews.
We're talking with Frederick Cruz. He's the author of Freud, The Making of an Illusion, and you can indeed join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. If you'd like to weigh in here on Freud, or if you have a question or comment for Professor Cruz, again, our number 866-733-6786, or email us forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Let me go to some of the comments that are coming in by email on the website. Brian asks or says, Freud believed that the essential character of a human being is that of a violent rapist. How could anyone anywhere come even close to believing anything such a man would say? It has always baffled me that Freud got anything more than pity. Well, I don't think that's quite accurate. He didn't see the basic human being as being a violent rapist. I don't know where Brian came across that. But you are critical of the way he sees basic humanity. You've used the word determinism a couple times, and that fits into his vision, certainly.
Yes, Freud felt that human character was developed in stages from a basic animality with which we are all born. He completely ignored the possibilities that human beings are innately social and sociable. And so he started with instinct, and the instincts were aggression and sex. And then he saw us as being shaped by essentially intimidation, social intimidation, into becoming more reasonable creatures. But, you know, his view of humanity as a whole was very misogynistic. Misanthropic as well as misogynistic.
Although it changed. Later on, he became kind of an anthropologist in some ways, more than a psychologist. By the time we got to Civilization and its Discontents, it was like he was having his whole view of humanity.
We could talk about Civilization and its Discontents. I don't do so in the book, but this is the book that most of your listeners are more likely to have read than any other. And it's regarded with great affection. Here is Freud, the wise guru, looking over all of history and particularly looking over the terrible 20th century and philosophizing about it. The point I would make about Civilization and its Discontents is that it is underwritten by psychological principles that don't happen to be true. Number one, the idea that civilization is built upon the sublimation of sexuality, which is progressive throughout history, so that we are now much more neurotic than we used to be. We have much less sexual freedom than we used to. This is obviously false. It just doesn't correspond to what we see around us in places like San Francisco, for example, Las Vegas, Paris. And secondly, at the end of that book, he talks about this great struggle between the instincts of life and death through history, and he expresses this wonderful hope that the life instinct will now take over the death instinct. Well, these instincts don't exist. He made them up. And it's just a terrible way to practice the writing of history, to reduce it all to concepts that are so large that the particulars of human interests get neglected.
What turned you away from Freud? You were quite infatuated with Freud as a young man.
Yes, that's right. I'm one of those literary types who found Freudianism quite attractive back in the 1960s. What changed my mind was the following. In the middle 1960s, I had a fellowship down at the Behavioral Sciences Center at Stanford, and I was supposed to be deepening my knowledge of Freud. Some of my fellows there drew me aside and said, you'd better read Karl Popper, you'd better read Sidney Hook, you'd better read Ernest Nagel. These people have fundamental critiques of psychoanalytic knowledge, and you should take account of them. I did that reading. Human nature is such that I was still very stubborn. It took me a while to realize that I had no answer to these critiques, that the critiques were right and that I was wrong.
We'll go to more of your calls. Let's go next to Tom. Tom, you're on.
Hi, Michael. Great show, as usual. My question is, what impact did Sigmund Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, have upon making his Freud's name a household name? His nephew was the so-called father of public relations. He actually wrote the book called Propaganda and had a huge impact on the way propaganda is used around the world today. What was the relationship between the two, and what impact did Freud have upon his nephew and his nephew upon him?
It's a very good question. There is a wonderful BBC movie, which is very hard to get from places like Netflix, but you can simply play it on YouTube, called The Century of the Self. And the first part of that movie is all about Edward Bernays and his effect on the advertising industry. He was the man who hooked American women on cigarettes, for example. Okay, he was Freud's nephew, and he cited Freud, but he certainly was not the person who popularized Freud in America. And indeed, although Bernays talked about the unconscious, he did so in a way that doesn't really bear very precisely on Freud's own ideas about the unconscious. So the relationship between these two people is rather tenuous. It's just interesting that self-promotion was a common theme between them.
You were talking before, and let me thank Tom for the call, about influences on you turning you away from Freud. Alan wants to know if you have a view of Swiss psychologist Alice Miller's critique of Freud, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about her.
Well, I'm afraid that Alice Miller was one of the founders of the recovered memory movement, about which I've written very critically back in 1994 for the New York Review of Books. I wrote a critique of this movement, focusing primarily on its use of the Freudian concept of repression. I'm afraid that Alice Miller was one of the theorists who stirred up a great deal of ideological unrest on the subject of recovered memory. It's not that child abuse isn't a terrible thing, but the issue in those days was whether or not one could rely on the recovery of repressed memories in order to actually identify people who had been molesters.
It was almost in vogue to have any kind of nightmares and trauma somehow tied to memories that were allegedly repressed. I mean, it became almost a phenomenon that was widespread.
It got a lot of people into jail and prison, actually. It took the concerted efforts of a lot of academic psychologists and people of goodwill to remind the lawyers and the judges that the nature of human memory is much, much different from this simple model where an early event is fixed in memory forever and can be retrieved intact.
And we'll retrieve some more of your calls. Let me go next to Berkeley. Peter, you're on the air.
Okay. The first comment I'd like to make is that there have been a lot of defenders of Freud, but something that hasn't come up is the pernicious influence of talk therapy on people with actual psychosis. It's not only wasted a lot of time in falsely, you know, treating people, but I think it's caused a lot of suffering. I know it has with my own sister, who is schizophrenic. But the other comment that I'd like to make is a couple of people have defended the use of dream therapy. In the 70s in Berkeley, I learned about the tarot process, you know, the fortune-telling with the tarot cards, and I realized that it works just the same as psychoanalysis does. The cards suggest things to the person who's being read, and they begin to talk about their difficulties and their problems, and it's kind of like the priesthood, too. So I think I'd like to hear some comments.
All right. Thank you for that. Appreciate the call, Peter. Frederick Cruz.
Well, on the point of applying psychoanalysis to people who are psychotic, and that is something that Freud himself unfortunately did in a number of cases, there's a book that I can recommend by Edward Dolnick, D-O-L-N-I-C-K, called Madness on the Couch. And it's about the extension of psychoanalytic ideas to problems that never should have been treated psychoanalytically, largely in the 1950s. It's a superb study that's probably about 20 years old by now. I won't comment on the rest of the caller's statements. I don't know that much about it.
We'll leave it stand. Todd wants to know, he says, I realize Freud was very obsessed with phallicism and had many issues, but he did take the lives of women and children seriously and listened to their problems. Perhaps if he had had access to today's computers and analytics, things might have been a bit different. And he wants to know what you think of neo-Freudians.
Okay. I'm going to skip the neo-Freudians, but I'm going to talk about Freud. I think the most common thing that is said in Freud's favor today is that he was a sympathetic listener, that he encouraged people to air their problems. He told them that it was safe to do so. He encouraged them to bring up horrible, traumatic memories and so forth. Now, this just really isn't so. We know a lot now about how Freud treated his patients. And by and large, what he did was to browbeat them. He came into sessions with a pretty clear idea of the general kind of trauma he would like to extract from patients. And when they didn't come up with such information, he insisted that they do so. In other words, he was the aggressor. He was not the listener.
Liliana writes, it took the personality and ambition of Freud to stop using straitjackets and start listening to patients. Psychoanalysis does not claim to follow a scientific method. It would be impossible. Freud aimed at celebrity and money? Wow. He must be the only one. A true biographer provides new knowledge on a subject, not a bashing of his ideas.
I think I've just lost a sale here.
Well, let's go to another caller, and we bring on Reed. Reed, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Karl Popper, because that was initially going to be my question, and that would have been about the current state of scientific method. You later moved away from Popper, and I wonder if you could comment on the current state of scientific method. We seem to act as if there's agreement about it, but I'm not sure that there is these days. The other thing I might add in a minor question is, how is it that English professors get involved in rather technical issues these days? I'm thinking maybe of Louis Menand at Harvard and other people. You are an example of that. Those are my questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Frederick Cruz.
Okay. Well, it seems to me that the scientific question that should be asked about Freud or about anybody else is simply, what is the basis for your belief in this idea as opposed to the other ideas that are in competition with it? I don't think that someone in the humanities is exempt from having to think about such things. We have our own knowledge problems, but in the long run, they're rather similar to those of a physicist. How do you justify your idea as opposed to someone else's? Now, one could say that the chief problem with Freud is that he never raised this question about his own ideas. If an idea occurred to him, it was good enough. He never took another theory and said, what tests can I apply to determine whether this theory is better than my theory? So these are kind of elementary, commonsensical human things.
What other theories existed for him to test his own theories against, though?
Oh, well.
What did you have in mind?
Freud's great rival was Pierre Janet. And Janet, by 1889, had developed a theory of recovering traumatic memories and curing patients of their neuroses. Freud didn't even coin the term psychoanalysis until 1896.
But he studied with Janet, didn't he?
No. It's funny. Janet was at the Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris pretty much at the same time that Freud was, but they were not acquainted. Charcot, the director, was entranced with Janet, who was a precocious young psychologist with tremendous promise. And when Freud proposed to his mentor, Joseph Breuer, that they go into a collaboration, which was, you know, studies on hysteria, it was because he was greatly concerned that Janet was preempting him in many respects. And I have a whole chapter about that.
Here's Aaron, who asks, the guest, Professor Cruz, briefly mentioned Freud's daughter, who wrote that children played with their food because they had anxiety about their feces. What was the role of Freud's daughter in creating the legend of Sigmund Freud? We've already touched upon that, but you want to say something more about it, Fred Cruz?
Well, I will say that one of the shocking episodes in Freud's life is that for periods adding up to about 4 years, he psychoanalyzed his own daughter. And one might almost say zombified her, because he made her essentially incapable of doing anything but being his own disciple. She lived a rather limited life, and the contents of her psychoanalysis were shocking. I mean, she was terribly worried about masturbation. She was worried about her incest wishes with regard to him. She was worried about her masochistic tendencies. And so he and she went over this stuff over and over again, and it all amounted to a kind of brainwashing, a kind of indoctrination that is really quite horrifying. And the psychoanalytic community knew all about it, but hid it from sight until about the 1970s, when it all started to come out.
Freud may not have been all that successful as a therapist, as you point out repeatedly, but he seems to have been pretty successful as a brainwasher. I mean, not only of his own daughter, but so many people who felt loyalty to him and were like apostles of his. I'll read a comment from Mike, actually a question and a comment. He said, Freud and Ludwig Wittgenstein were both Austrians and essentially contemporaries, but I'm unaware of Wittgenstein having much to say about Freud, even though Freud's mystification of language would have been an anathema to Wittgenstein. Do you have any knowledge about Wittgenstein's thoughts on Freud?
Yes, there's a whole book on the subject. And Wittgenstein talked about what he called Freud's fishy charm. He thought that Freud's ideas were attractive in a way that we should really try to resist. And he was particularly satirical about the idea of the unconscious. He called the unconscious Mr. Nobody. He said, instead of saying, I don't know what's going on, he said, Mr. Nobody is here. So Freud personified the unconscious. He allegorized the unconscious. Wittgenstein saw that this theory had tremendous power to propagate itself, but he wanted to warn you that it was not such a good idea.
You know who was even more critical of Freud than that, or probably even than you have been of Freud? Nabokov.
Ah, well, Nabokov called Freud the Viennese witch doctor. And I'll tell you about Nabokov's favorite passage in Freud. It's a letter that he wrote to his friend Wilhelm Fliess. He talks about a patient of his who, at the age of 14, lived at the base of the mountain, the Jungfrau, and he is said to have masturbated while watching the Jungfrau, because Jungfrau means maiden. This, I think, is in a way the supreme example of nutty cause and effect reasoning, and you could count on someone with Nabokov's satirical capacities to have lit upon it.
Again, our guest, Frederick Kruse, his book about Sigmund Freud is called Freud, The Making of an Illusion, and good to have you back with us on Forum. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Michael, and let me just say that I want to join those who congratulate you on such a great career right here.
Very kind of you and appreciated. Thank you for that. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We always welcome your responses and thoughts about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear. You can email them to us, forum@kqed.org. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about poetry in this hour with Matthew Zapruder, who is a professor at St. Mary's College and who has written a book which really makes the case for poetry and says people aren't reading it right. They need to read it without thinking that there are deep symbolic codes in there, and it's almost refreshing to read a book like that. You'll hear about that tomorrow. Thank you for being a part of the program today, and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.